was me. I would want a piece of what was left. I wrote to your dad, and that is what he sent me.
So he did know, Taylor said absently, looking down at the gift.
The shell is from outside on the beach, Copano continued. I guess that's kind of obvious.
It's like they're growing together, Taylor said, fingering the spot where a smooth shell met rough wood.
I used my legacy to fuse them. Made the wood transparent, slid it into the shell, and released. Same thing with the laurelite.
Copano turned the piece over, so Taylor could examine the laurelite embedded in the shell. Their fingers brushing as he did. The azure slivers were arranged in the shape of a lauric glyph. Taylor only knew what they were because of a TV special she'd seen about lauric mysteries in the wake of the invasion.
Where'd you get...
After our little adventure, Copano said, I may have pocketed some of the broken stones. Not enough to teleport. At least, I don't think so. But still cool. I got Lexa's help with the symbol. It means home in their language. But it can also mean here, like where you are at any given moment. I don't know. It seemed fitting.
Taylor gave a small, disbelieving shake of her head.
Copano, it's amazing. I love it.
He clapped his hands and blew out a relieved exhale.
I'm glad.
Taylor pulled the necklace on over her head and fluffed her hair loose from the leather band. She turned it so the lauric symbol was facing out, liking how the rough wood felt against her skin. A reminder of home. Copano grinned.
Ah, prettier than I'd even imagined.
Ha, shut up, Taylor laughed, rolling her eyes. Her lips pursed suddenly, as a thought occurred to her, and her shoulders slumped a bit.
The thing is, Copano, we all agreed we weren't doing presents, and it's not like there's somewhere for us to shop anyway. Not that that stopped you from making this awesome gift, which... I'm not good at crafts. My art projects always got thrown in the garbage.
She realized she was rambling.
What I'm saying is that I'm sorry, but I didn't get you anything.
Copano waved this away like he was offended at the very thought.
I didn't expect you to. The point of the holiday is giving, not receiving, yes?
Taylor's gaze drifted away from Copano as an idea hit her. More an urge than an idea, really. Her eyes darted across the many holiday decorations that the faculty had placed all around the student union. She knew it was here somewhere. Ah, there. Right over the entrance, of course. She squinted and put her telekinesis to work.
There is something I've wanted to give you for a while, though, she said, and gave her eyebrows a goofy pump so that Copano would look up.
A piece of mistletoe hovered above them.
What is it? Copano asked. A plant?
As usual, Taylor couldn't tell whether Copano was joking or not. She didn't care. Without another word, she went up on her toes and kissed him. Maybe she'd surprised him at first, but he caught on quickly, returning the kiss, his hand on the small of her back. Taylor leaned against him, not wanting to stop, her fingers tickling the stubble on his jawline. Taylor lost track of time, forgot about all the burdens and dangers she was facing, and could think of only Copano's warm mouth. When they finally pulled apart, they were both out of breath, which made them laugh. Taylor reached out and held Copano's hand.
Merry Christmas, she said.
Chapter 10. Caleb Crane. The Crane Residence, Omaha, Nebraska. Caleb sat in one of the straight-backed living room chairs and fed wrapping paper into the fireplace, watching cartoon snowmen curl into themselves as the little blaze consumed them. Presents were over. His gifts were stacked in a tidy pile next to him. He'd received the usual: socks and underwear, plain white t-shirts in a plastic package, a few solid-color polo shirts, a good pair of blue jeans, and a pair of sturdy boots. Every year, Caleb's dad made it very clear to Caleb's mother that the boys were to receive practical gifts that they could use. His dad was a sergeant at Offutt Air Force Base, where he was known as a stern disciplinarian. He brought that attitude home with him and didn't let up, even on holidays. Thinking about it, Santa had always been a real drag in the Crane household. Caleb's most exciting gift every year, if you could call it that, was whatever hardcover book of history his dad picked out for him. Without fail, it would be something that Charles Crane had read before, so that he could quiz the boys come January. This year's selection was about the mysterious death of George Patton, written by some newscaster Caleb had seen on TV ranting red-faced about how dangerous guard integration was for the future of the United States. Caleb resisted the urge to toss the book in the fire. Caleb's mom was in the kitchen, preparing dinner. His dad was in the den, watching a football game. And his brothers... well, they were sitting on the couch opposite Caleb, grinning like wolves. Charles Jr., or Charlie as he was called around the house, was the oldest, 6 years Caleb's senior. Christopher was the middle son, only 18 months younger than Charlie. Caleb often wondered if things would have been different if his two older brothers hadn't been so close in age, if they'd all been spread out more, or if there had been a fourth brother, younger than Caleb, to even the odds. He wondered if they would have ganged up on him less, if any of those things were true. They all looked alike, a fact that Caleb couldn't help but find ironic. All the Crane boys possessed the same sandy blonde hair, square jaws, and ears a little too big for their heads. Charlie kept his hair buzzed short and proper, like their father. He was already something of a big shot at Offutt, an officer at only 23, following in his father's footsteps. Chris kept his hair a little longer, and Caleb got the sense that he'd trimmed it off his ears and shaved his sideburns fresh for this trip home, not wanting to invoke their dad's ire. Not that Chris would ever admit to that. He was at Omaha Community College, studying engineering, after he'd gotten the boot from the Air Force Academy last year. What he'd done to land in trouble was a big secret, but Caleb knew from a whispered conversation with his mom that Charles Sr. could have pulled some strings for Chris's benefit and kept him enlisted. His dad had refused. No special treatment for his boys. They screwed up. That was on them. Caleb didn't feel sorry for Chris. His dad's rules, "You fight your own battles," had caused him to get the shit kicked out of him by his older brothers on a weekly basis. No one ever stepped in for him. "Can I ask you a question?" That was Chris. Caleb must have been staring at him. Maybe Caleb was smirking a little bit, thinking about the misfortune that had befallen his brother. That was a mistake. It was always better to avoid eye contact in this house. "What?" Caleb replied. Chris took a swig from his bottle of beer. He'd gotten a bit of a potbelly since Caleb last saw him. Both his brothers were drinking, a small colony of bottles on the coffee table in front of them. "Now that you're a big-shot mutant or whatever," Chris began, "can we still call you Caleb?"
"You should never have called me that in the first place," Caleb replied quietly. "Actually, my roommate Nigel is gay."
Caleb wouldn't have been able to explain why he said that. He always did that kind of thing when he was younger and getting stared down by his brothers. Volunteered information, overshared, gave them ammunition. In his sessions with Dr. Linda, before they found out she was an evil spy for the Foundation, she had suggested that Caleb's anxiety about his brothers was why he was so taciturn and repressed. Charlie sucked his teeth at the mention of Nigel.
I'll never understand how these goddamn aliens picked who got superpowers.
Legacies, Caleb corrected.
Whatever.
Charlie was much subtler than Chris when it came to insults. Always had been.
That's sweet, Chris butted in, leering at Caleb. You and this kid make out all the time?
No, we don't make out, Caleb said flatly. You're ignorant as shit. Chris barked a laugh.
I'm ignorant? You hear that, dude?
He asked, nudging Charlie.
Little brother goes off to freak school in California, and all of a sudden he talks like some liberal blogger. You going to lecture me about trigger warnings next?
Before Caleb could reply, Charlie wrapped his arm around Chris and pulled him close, smiling slyly.
Bro, do you remember the year of Santa Claus?
Charlie asked Chris in a stage whisper. Chris clapped a hand over his face.
You mean the best Christmas ever? How could I forget that?
Charlie grinned at Caleb.
You remember that?
Yeah, Caleb replied. I remember. Santa Claus. That was what the brothers considered to be one of their better pranks. It was Christmas Eve, and Caleb had only managed to get to sleep after what felt like hours of tossing and turning, too excited about the morning to come. Chris had shaken him awake, whispered in his ear,
"Wake up, Caleb. I think I hear Santa Claus."
How had Caleb been so stupid? He shook his head at the memory. He was young and hadn't yet learned to be suspicious of everything his older brothers said and did.
You were so damn excited, Chris laughed, recounting the story. Kept trying to hold my hand and shit.
Caleb remembered. He was excited. It was like they were on a secret mission. He was almost more thrilled that Chris had thought to include him than he was to see Santa Claus. They crept through the house, towards the living room where Caleb sat now. They could hear the rustle of wrapping paper and booted footfalls. Caleb peeked around the corner and had to clap a hand over his mouth to stifle a gasp. Santa was really there, his back to them as he rummaged through the presents, a red suit and curly white hair, just like in the storybooks.
I shoved him around the corner, Chris said, wiping his eyes.
And that's when I turned around, Charlie added.
Santa loomed over young Caleb. He wasn't like the stories at all. Huge fangs filled his mouth, and his face was smeared with blood. Instead of fingers, he had long claws that shone in the Christmas tree's blinking lights.
Ho, 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 Santa had bellowed. You're going to die.
His brothers were cracking up now.
Had all that fake blood and the vampire teeth left over from Halloween, Charlie explained. Took us a while to tape all the steak knives to my fingers.
Worth it, Chris said.
Totally worth it.
Young Caleb had shrieked and run upstairs, sobbing and hysterical when he launched himself into his parents' bed. That was, as it happened, how he learned that Santa wasn't real.
You pissed your pants, too, Chris said.
I was 8, replied Caleb.
I think Dad was madder about that than the prank, Charlie said with a smirk. They'd just gotten you over the whole bedwetting thing.
How long did we get grounded for?
Chris asked, shaking his head.
Oh, man, so long.
Always telling on us, Chris said to Caleb, taking a disapproving swig of beer.
I thought there was a monster in the house, Caleb replied.
And what had been the aftermath of Santa Claus?
For starters, Caleb had to endure a stern lecture about how neither Santa Claus nor monsters were real, and how he needed to develop some backbone. The older boys had gotten grounded for a month, which, of course, they viewed as Caleb's fault, because he couldn't take a joke.
You guys beat me up almost every day for like a month after that, Caleb said quietly.
What else were we supposed to do? Charlie asked innocently.
It was boring being stuck in the house, Chris said with a chuckle.
I'd like to see you try that now.
Caleb flinched and glanced over his shoulder. One of his duplicates had sprung loose. He stood behind Caleb with his arms crossed, glaring at the brothers. Both Charlie and Chris had fallen silent. Their eyes were wide, Chris frozen with his beer bottle in front of his mouth. It occurred to Caleb that his brothers had never seen what he could do. The first duplicate had been an accident, but Caleb decided to go with it. In a moment, there were six copies of Caleb, three on either side of his chair. They stood there cracking their knuckles or rolling their necks, like they were getting ready for a fight. Caleb sat back calmly, one eyebrow raised.
"Sucks to be outnumbered, doesn't it?" he asked.
Charlie swallowed with some difficulty.
"Easy now, bro. We were just messing around."
At a mental command, each of the duplicates took one forceful step forward. Charlie yelped. Chris threw himself over the back of the couch. Caleb laughed. He couldn't remember ever openly laughing at his brothers like that. Of course, the victory was short-lived.
"What in the hell is this?"
Caleb's dad stood in the doorway, drawn away from his football game by the commotion. He looked from the gang of duplicates on one side of the room to his older boys cowering on the other. His thin lips curled in stern disgust, which he aimed directly at Caleb.
"Didn't think I'd have to make this clear, boy, but I don't want none of that alien shit going on in my house."
"Or what?" one of the duplicates asked. His father's face turned red, all the way up through his buzz cut. He wasn't used to insubordination in any facet of life. He glared at the offending duplicate, then at Caleb.
"I know that thing didn't just sass me,"
Caleb's dad said icily.
"In my own house."
Caleb stared at his dad, whose face just got redder and redder. His palms were sweaty. He knew that he should back down and defuse the situation by absorbing his duplicates. He'd probably already gone too far by using them to intimidate his brothers. Guard weren't supposed to use their legacies against defenseless humans, even if they were total jerks. But then, what could Caleb's dad actually do to him? Caleb didn't live here, didn't eat his food, didn't rely on him in any way. His dad didn't have any power over him. Caleb hadn't even wanted to come home in the first place, and tomorrow he'd be whisked right back to the academy. Caleb was free of all this. And yet, his father's glare made him feel small again.
"Please, Caleb, can we just listen to Dad? He looks so mad."
Caleb flinched. That mewling voice was his own. One of the duplicates had broken ranks with the others and was half doubled over like he might vomit from nervousness, wringing his hands together and staring pleadingly at Caleb. It had been months since Caleb had last allowed his feelings to overwhelm him and lost control of one of the clones. For a while, Caleb had thought his duplicates had minds of their own, or at least that's what he tried to convince himself. But really, they were like emotional release valves,
too much pressure in Caleb's head, and one of them could act out. Of course, it would happen right after his big moment of triumph over his brothers. They were both smirking now, Chris snickering behind his hand, even though he was still half hiding behind the couch. With every second that the duplicate fretted and whined, Caleb's dad looked less angry and more mystified. His mom, meanwhile, cooked dinner in the kitchen, pretending nothing was going on, like always. The duplicate made a wet sucking noise, flapping its lower lip like it was trying to keep itself from crying. The embarrassment was too real. Caleb shot to his feet and absorbed the duplicates. Not making eye contact with any of them, he stormed out of the room. His father let him go. Too weirded out, probably.
"Did you see that?"
he heard Charles ask Chris.
"He's a goddamn mental case," Chris replied.
Caleb grabbed his coat and walked right out of the house. He only made it as far as the porch. It was freezing outside, no more than 20 degrees, a dusting of frost on everything. Caleb's fingers tingled and his cheeks stung. What was he doing? Running away from home? He'd already kind of accomplished that. No. He was just getting some air. That was the manly thing to do. Cool down. Let it blow over. He sat down on the porch swing, the wooden slats freezing on the backs of his legs, the metal chains creaking at his weight. He stuffed his hands in his pockets and blew out a cloud of mist. He shivered. This was miserable, but he'd stay out here all night if he had to. Skip dinner. Wait for everyone to go to bed. Get out of here in the morning. That was a good plan. A set of headlights lit up the quiet block. Caleb watched them come. They belonged to a black SUV, the kind with heavily tinted windows and armor plating down on the sides. A government vehicle for sure, which wasn't such an unusual sight, being so close to the military base. He'd been driven from the airport in a car just like it, the UN peacekeepers not breaking off until he was safely ensconced with his family. He glanced down the block. His bodyguards were still there, parked at a respectful distance to keep watch. He felt sympathy for the small detachment of peacekeepers who had to spend the day sitting around a nothing block in Omaha. At least someone was having a worse Christmas than him. To Caleb's surprise, the SUV pulled into his driveway. For a moment, he let himself hope that this was his ride to the airport and they'd come to collect him early. Then, the SUV's back door opened, and his uncle stepped out.
"Did I miss dinner?"
Retired General Clarence Lawson wore a fur-trimmed black parka that hung open, revealing a tacky Hawaiian shirt and khaki pants beneath. He rubbed his hands together, breathed into them, then hastily zipped up his coat. His silver buzz cut stood out in the night, accentuated by his leathery tan. Uncle Clarence didn't come to Christmas in Omaha. Ever. Either he was too busy with work, or, after he retired, he was too busy enjoying golf courses drenched in the Florida sun. He was Caleb's mom's older brother, and at other family events over the years, Caleb had occasionally perceived some tension between Clarence and his father. That was to be expected. They were both military men, but Caleb's dad's career had plateaued at sergeant, whereas Clarence was once the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the highest-ranking officer in the country. He was now something of an American hero. Uncle Clarence had been called out of retirement during the invasion to coordinate the resistance against the Mogadorians and was widely credited for unifying the world's many governments, not to mention the Lorik, around a cohesive battle strategy. At first, Caleb was surprised to see him there. But then it dawned on him that this was exactly why he'd gotten special dispensation to come home for Christmas. The general wanted to see him.
"You frozen to death?"
General Lawson asked as he clomped up the steps onto the porch.
"Or did you not hear me?"
Caleb blinked, then shrugged in response to his uncle's original question.
"They might be eating. I don't know."
"Don't care if you're missing dinner, huh?"
Clarence glanced towards the front door, frowning.
"They up your ass already?"
Caleb shrugged again. His uncle was trying to be all jocular and friendly, but Caleb didn't buy it. The last time they'd seen each other had been at a military base on an island, Guantanamo, Nigel always theorized, where they put the guard no one knew what to do with while the academy was built. Things there hadn't been great. Nonetheless, Clarence sat down on the swing next to Caleb.
"Going to make an old man sit out here and freeze? Okay, that's your prerogative."
He reached inside his coat and pulled out a long metal case, producing a cigar from within.
"You want one?"
"No, thanks."
"Hmm. There was a time that would have been, no thank you, sir."
Clarence was half-joking with the criticism, but Caleb bristled. It was too close to something his dad would say. Caleb felt the sudden urge to release one of his duplicates and fought it back. Meanwhile, the general held a Zippo to his cigar, puffing obliviously until a thick cloud of fragrant smoke wafted up from the tip.
"How are things at the academy?"
Clarence asked as he settled in next to Caleb.
"Fine."
"Heard you got in a bit of trouble. Unauthorized departure from campus. Maybe some more serious violations of guard protocol."
"Why did you bring me here?" Caleb asked sharply.
When his uncle didn't answer right away, he pressed on.
"You did bring me here, right? Pulled strings?"
"I am your uncle, Caleb."
"I haven't heard from you in more than a year," Caleb replied. "You must want something."
The general's eyes narrowed. He tapped ash off his cigar.
"They've changed you at that place. Used to be you were loyal, eager to please."
Caleb opened his mouth to reply, but Clarence raised his cigar to stop him.
"Not saying it's a bad thing. It's good you're becoming your own man. I thought we understood each other, but if you've got a problem with me..."
"You made us give away our chimerae," Caleb blurted. "And I helped you. I can't believe I helped you do that. What was I thinking?"
"You were following an order, just like I was,"
Lawson replied quietly.
"We didn't know what might happen with those creatures."
Caleb looked his uncle in the eyes.
"Are they dead? Or are they, like, getting poked and prodded in a laboratory somewhere?"
Lawson met his gaze steadily.
"Honestly, son, I don't know. I could look into it for you."
"Don't do me any favors," Caleb replied, looking away.
Clarence silently puffed away on his cigar for a few cold seconds.
"I'll be straight with you," he said at last. "I got you this little vacation from the academy, so I could be the one to tell you. They're promoting you to Earth Guard."
Caleb's mouth fell open.
"What?"
"I've still got friends in the organization. They gave me the heads up. Prevailing wisdom after your skirmish with those harvester folks is that you're ready for field work. Not to mention, reports from the psychiatrists there have greatly improved."
Caleb's whole body felt numb, and not from the cold.
I'm leaving the academy?"
"Should go through in the next week or so. You're going to be on a detachment with Melanie Jackson herself.
The prospect of working alongside the president's daughter did nothing to diminish the dread Caleb was feeling. They were doing important work at the academy, planning against the foundation. He couldn't leave. Not yet. I'm not ready.
Earth Guard seems to think otherwise.
Clarence paused and leaned forward to make eye contact with Caleb.
Thing is, I'm also here to ask you for a favor.
A favor?
Like I said, I've still got colleagues involved with the Earth Guard program. Some of them have approached me about concerns they're having.
What kind of concerns? Now his uncle got cagey.
Nothing they can put their finger on exactly. Just oddities here and there. Strange allocations of resources. Preferential treatment, that sort of thing. You remember why they called me out of retirement in the first place? Back during the invasion?
Because the Moogs had corrupted too many people in the government, Caleb answered distractedly. They needed someone they could trust.
That's right, Clarence replied. Authorities made a lot of arrests in the year after the invasion. But suppose they didn't catch them all, huh? Maybe there's still some Moog Pro people out there. What would they be doing now, do you think?
They'd be figuring out ways to exploit the new world, Caleb said. To use the guard to their advantage.
Maybe so.
Lawson nodded.
You have any experience with organizations like that?
Caleb looked at his uncle. How much did he know? Was he dropping hints that the Foundation could be tied to remnants of Moog Pro? Or was this all just a big coincidence? Caleb pictured the tidbits of research they'd gathered and theories they'd mulled over. Should he share that with his uncle? Clarence puffed innocently at his cigar, like the two boys were just out here chewing the fat in the freezing cold.
No, Caleb said. Haven't heard about anything like that. Just guessing.
Caleb stared down at his hands. For a moment, his fingers doubled. 20 of them, interlaced in his lap, shaking slightly. A duplicate trying to get loose to tell his uncle the truth. He caught himself just in time. He was agitated, conflicted. That was always when he lost control. He took a deep breath, steadied himself. Maybe his uncle had good intentions and was on the side of the guard. But he'd taken away the Chimera Eye. He'd used Caleb in the past. Caleb couldn't trust him. He could only trust his friends at the academy. He forced himself to be of one mind on this. The indecision lasted only a few seconds. If his uncle noticed anything awry, he didn't say anything. In fact, he changed the subject.
You know who Wade Seidel is, Caleb?
The weapons manufacturer, Caleb replied. He makes all the gear the peacekeepers will use on us if we ever get out of
hand. Lawson snorted.
I've seen what guard can do. If you lot set your mind to do something, I don't think Seidel's trinkets will make much difference in the long run. That said, our country's investing a great deal in his guard deterrence. He's an old friend of President Jackson, you know. Big campaign contributor.
Caleb recalled how the Harvesters were armed with anti-guard technology, presumably supplied by the Foundation. He and his friends hadn't been able to figure out whether the gear was stolen or Seidel was double-dealing.
You think he's one of them? Caleb asked.
One of whom?
Caleb winced. He'd slipped up, forgotten he was supposed to be talking around the existence of the Foundation.
One of your
I don't know, Caleb said, covering. Conspirators? Moog sympathizers? You won't even say. Clarence tapped ash off his cigar, chuckling.
Doubt it. I was just reading an article about him on the flight up. Interesting guy. Maybe you'll have a chance to meet him once you're in Earthguard. I'd love to hear what you think.
Okay, Caleb said.
You'll do great out there. But keep your eyes open, Clarence said, and patted Caleb on the knee. If you see anything odd, or even if something doesn't feel right, you know how to reach me.
Yeah, Caleb replied. He was still coming to terms with all this. He'd be leaving the academy, just when he was finally settling in. Okay. And that was that. General Lawson stood up, wet the tips of his fingers, and pinched the end of his cigar. He shook some feeling into his feet.
I'm going to go see what your mom's cooking, he said. Don't freeze out here, son.
Caleb nodded and watched his uncle go inside. A shiver came over him, and he huddled deeper into his coat, staring down the darkened street. You really can't go home again, he muttered to himself. Or maybe the expression should be, you shouldn't go home again. No one replied. For once, all the duplicates agreed with him. Chapter 11 The Fugitive 6 The Human Guard Academy, Point Reyes, California. Lunchtime, and the dining hall was bustling with activity. Groups of students filed through the buffet line, filled their trays, and lounged around tables. Others scarfed down lunches and rushed off. Some kids still hadn't finished their end-of-semester assignments, and it was the last day to get those in. It was New Year's Eve. Copano smiled, enjoying all the activity. He picked up a corner of his turkey sandwich and leisurely bit into it. He didn't have anything to do today except wait for the night's festivities. On the second floor, volunteers were hanging streamers and cardboard Happy New Year signs. That wouldn't take long with Maiken Megalos and her super speed zipping around up there. With Nigel and Caleb at an emergency band practice, Ran in training, and Isabella who knows where, that meant Copano was eating his lunch alone. He didn't mind. From his table, he had a clear view of Taylor serving food. Dining hall duty was part of her punishment for decking Isabella. He thought she looked good, even in a hairnet. Copano spaced out, thinking about that kiss on Christmas Eve, and wondering how he could arrange a repeat performance without blowing Taylor's cover. He didn't notice the chatter in the room die down. He probably would have missed the whole broadcast if Simon, sitting at a nearby table, hadn't called his name.
Copano, Simon said, pointing up at the TV. Isn't that you?
Someone had put on Wolf News. Copano was familiar with the American network from his current events class. They broadcast a lot of stories about lurking aliens and dangerous guard. Everyone knew their coverage was slanted, so it wasn't a channel that typically got played in the student union. Yet all eyes were on the TV now. The screen was split. On the left was the host, Don Leary, a red-faced man in his late 50s, his majestic head of ink-black hair plugs swept back. On the right was some grainy cell phone video, the same clip repeating over and over.
I repeat, this footage is not for the faint of heart, Leary gravely declared. Even after the harrowing events of the Mogadorian invasion, it's still disconcerting to see these superpowered things in action. But what makes this even harder to watch is that these aren't extraterrestrial invaders being assaulted. These are American citizens. And the attackers? Not aliens either. Human beings. Ones supposedly being trained to protect us.
Copano focused on the looped footage. It was dark and jumpy, filmed by someone hiding behind the back end of a car. Even so, Copano recognized the location. It was the stretch of California Highway where the Fugitive Six had fought the Harvesters. In the video, the sky lit up. A tracer of red cut through the dark, descended, and exploded. Bodies flew up from the blast site, limp and lifeless. A motorcycle careened by, flipped end over end. Another glow ignited down the road. The person filming zoomed in towards the source of the fireworks, revealing Ran with glowing objects in either hand. As the camera filmed, she hurled one of these bombs at a passing motorcyclist, knocking him off and sending his bike skittering. The camera suddenly jolted. Someone had been viciously thrown against the car the camera person used for cover. The view zoomed out just in time to reveal Copano punching a biker across the face with enough force to bend his body over backwards. Copano watched himself turn, empty-eyed, emotionless, and charged the camera. The video cut off there. Of course, the nice people at Wolf News immediately started it over. Leary spoke over the clip.
Our sources have identified the two assailants in the video as students at the UN's Human Guard Academy in California. Their names and countries of origin are being kept private because they're minors, but the footage speaks for itself. This is a heinous attack on American soil by two dangerous individuals drunk on their own power. It is exactly the kind of incident the government promised wouldn't happen as a result of the academy. Do you feel safer with hundreds of these creatures running wild in our own backyard? I certainly don't.
Copano looked away, his eyes blurry with frustrated tears. He wiped his face on the back of his hand, hoping that no one else in the student union would notice. Luckily, most of his peers were also watching the news broadcast. Or maybe that wasn't lucky at all. They were all seeing Copano, literally out of his mind, viciously beat ordinary people. The broadcast switched over to an interview with a leather-clad man in a neck brace. A harvester. He claimed that they were just a group of bikers out for a peaceful ride when they were accosted by the guard. The host treated him sympathetically, asking him softball questions. Copano tuned it out, his ears ringing. He stood up, harder than he'd meant to, and knocked over his chair. Everyone was looking at him now. Simon scooted his chair backwards, like he was afraid of Copano. Copano's fists were clenched, a fact he didn't even realize until Taylor appeared at his side and squeezed her fingers through his.
It's all a lie, she said,
not caring that such a display might jeopardize her rebellious reputation. She raised her voice a bit so the other students could hear.
What they're saying isn't how it went down at all. Missionary bikers on a ride for Jesus? Give me a break. Look at these clips. How convenient that they edited out all the parts where they shoot guns at us.
Some nearby students murmured agreement. But a few also edged away from Copano. And others whispered to each other behind their hands.
Look at me. Copano said, crestfallen.
The news was rerunning the clip over and over.
I look like a monster.
Taylor squeezed his hand tighter,
That's not you, she replied. Don't worry. This will get sorted out. Professor Nine will have your back.
When the news broke, Ran was in the training center with Nine. While most of the other students had left for lunch or free time, Ran wanted another run at the obstacle course. She wouldn't use her legacies. Her new thing was to see how far she could make it relying only on her natural physical abilities. Grinning, Nine had taken up the challenge beside her. They were both sweating, panting, and sore. As they ran across adjacent balance beams, a log attached to two steel chains swung down from the ceiling at them. Ran slid down on her knees, ducking beneath the battering ram. She just managed to keep steady on the beam by hooking her foot around the narrow railing. Nine, on the other hand, opted to leap over the log. Ran saw him come down, foot off kilter, practically on the side of the balance beam. But he didn't slip. He stuck right there and quickly readjusted.
Cheating, Ran scolded. You're using your anti-gravity.
Nine gritted his teeth.
It's reflex. I can't help it. I'm too good.
Ran rolled her eyes and continued on, leaping from the beam to a set of monkey bars with rungs that let loose an electric shock if she hung on too long. Out of the corner of her eye, she spotted a small commotion at the entrance. Dr. Good and Gregor Carlson had just entered. The two of them hunched over a tablet as they speedwalked, looking like they were in the middle of an argument.
Nine, Dr. Good called out. You need to see this.
The tone of Malcolm's voice caused Ran to hesitate just a moment too long. The bars sent a jolt into her palms and she dropped off them, gnashing her teeth. Nine was already down, walking over to Malcolm and Gregor with his hands on his hips.
What's up? He asked. I'm trying to get my sweat on.
Ran normally wasn't nosy, but something told her she should probably pay attention to this meeting. Maybe it was the way Gregor looked at her, with a weird half-smile, like he knew something that she didn't. Curious, Ran followed Nine, peeking over his shoulder to get a look at the tablet. They watched the same broadcast that Copano and Taylor had seen in the student union, the one that millions of homes across the world were tuned into at that very moment. Other stations were starting to pick up the story, too, not to mention the websites and blogs. Ran and Copano were officially famous for attacking some allegedly saintly bikers. Nine looked up from the video.
So what? This is bullshit. Call a press conference and tell them the truth.
The truth, Gregor replied with a raised eyebrow,
that you allowed a half-dozen students to escape and that they caused chaos. That is already out there.
Yeah, yeah. I look like a dummy. Earth Guard reviews my performance. Knows that they need me more than I need them, blah, 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 this blows over.
Nine stared down his nose at Gregor.
The truth I'm talking about is that my students were attacked by some psychos and a mind controller. That video paints them as criminals, but they were acting in self-defense.
Aw, that's truth, Gregor replied, stroking his chin. That is a bit more problematic. It would involve Earth Guard admitting that there are rogue guard out there, ones we can't actually control. This incident getting out is already quite a PR nightmare. We don't need to add to it.
PR nightmare, Malcolm repeated, pinching the bridge of his nose.
Makes me pine for the days of Mogadorian warships.
What is going to happen to us? Ran spoke up at last, all three of the administrators turning in her direction. Copano and me. What will happen?
That, Ms. Takeda, is a very good question, Gregor replied.
You're sure that we're ready for this? Nigel asked.
Caleb looked up as he eased a bass guitar into its case. He didn't hear Nigel talk like that often, his voice devoid of its customary brashness. He couldn't help but smile.
"You're nervous," Caleb observed.
"Nah, mate," Nigel replied quickly.
He sipped daintily at the cup of tea he'd microwaved for himself. Good for the vocal cords, he claimed.
"I just thought we agreed we weren't going out for this dumb monkey show thing."
A pack of Caleb's clones made a racket at the back of the room, dismantling a drum set and transferring it onto a dolly. They were on one of the dormitory's uninhabited floors, in the room they'd converted into a makeshift rehearsal space. Caleb wouldn't necessarily have described their band as good. They'd only been practicing together for a month, and Caleb didn't have any prior experience with the drums, the keyboard, or the bass guitar, all instruments he was expected to play. He had been practicing, though. Well, his clones had been practicing. Caleb multitasked. He often found himself sending one of his duplicates up here to work with an instrument, while Caleb himself remained stuck in a classroom or doing chores. It was a strain, but totally worth it. They knew three songs, all of them pretty simple. Nigel had picked them out based on some metric he came up with. Ease of learning versus badassness. None of them were longer than 3 minutes, and all of them contained ample opportunities for Nigel to scream.
"It has to be tonight," Caleb said. "We aren't going to get another chance."
"What? How do you figure?"
Caleb sighed and snapped the clasps closed on the guitar case. He straightened up and looked at Nigel.
"I'm leaving," he said. "Getting sent to Earthguard."
Nigel practically spit out a mouthful of tea.
"Come again?"
"Uncle Clarence told me over Christmas," Caleb said. "Apparently I'll be leaving in the next few days."
"You've been back for like a week," Nigel replied. "Why didn't you say anything?"
Caleb shrugged and bent down, pretending to dust off the guitar case.
"I don't know. I didn't want to make a big deal of it."
"You plan to just disappear into the night, then, without telling any of us?"
Nigel set down his tea and came closer, putting a hand on Caleb's shoulder.
"I know we weren't always tight, but you're one of us. We care about you, brother."
"I know," Caleb replied.
The duplicates stopped what they were doing and swooped in, wrapping up both Nigel and Caleb in a group hug.
"Ugh, get a hold of yourselves," Nigel complained, laughing.
When he could breathe again, his mouth screwed up in thought.
"You know, you don't have to let them enlist you. We're on to something here. The work we're doing with Nine and the others seems like it's just as important as any Earthguard mission. That twat Gregor is always trying to promote Ran. She keeps refusing to use her powers, so he doesn't."
Caleb shot a look at his duplicates, who had gone back to breaking down the drum kit.
"I don't know. Not using my legacy," Caleb scratched the back of his neck, "probably wouldn't be healthy for me."
"Yeah, good point," Nigel admitted. "Besides, my uncle, he was being pretty weird about stuff. I almost got the sense that he was feeling me out about the Foundation."
Nigel's eyebrows shot up.
"Feeling you out like he wants to take them down too, or like he's one of them?"
"Honestly, I don't know. But I don't think my uncle is the type to work with them. He's got too big a stick up his ass," Nigel said.
"Exactly.
He danced around actually telling me anything. Probably worried about compromising top-secret intel," Caleb shrugged. "So I didn't tell him anything either."
"Good lad."
"He mentioned Wade Seidel, though. Like, I might get assigned to do something for him. And since his name has popped up in our investigation, I figure maybe I should go along with it. See what I can find out and report back to you guys."
Nigel rubbed his pockmarked cheek in thought.
Better than sitting around here waiting for the Foundation to make a move, he said at last.
Yeah, Caleb replied.
But you've got to tell the others, Nigel said.
I will, Caleb replied. He looked around at the duplicates, who were done with the packing, and now stared blankly into space, awaiting further orders.
So, guess we've got a talent show to get to.
Let's melt some faces, mates.
Chapter 12. Duan Fen. Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada.
The look on his face. I'm not sure it will ever get old.
Duan Fen let go of the guard she was holding as Einar spoke. She'd been grasping him by the throat, letting her electric current fry his synapses. He fell at her feet, barely breathing, curls of smoke rising up from his dark suit. He looked virtually identical to all the bodyguards she'd worked with in the past. Burly and arrogant, easy for her to take out, even with a bad leg.
The Foundation, Einar continued his musing. They think their money will keep them safe. Like they can just buy and sell us without repercussions.
Duan Fen gave the guard at her feet a swift kick for emphasis.
The guards aren't rich. They're only lackeys.
Einar stepped around another guard who had shot at them, his gun now bent into a pretzel shape around his broken hands, thanks to Einar's telekinesis.
I don't mean these fools, Einar explained in that know-it-all way of his, that Duan Fen found mildly infuriating. You're right, though. There's no real pleasure to be taken from dispatching some thugs for hire.
I didn't say that.
Duan Fen sneered at the men crumpled at their feet.
A trainer of mine used to say, choose a violent life, expect a violent end. Certain people, men usually, think that rule doesn't apply to them. They are always surprised when...
She dragged a thumb across her throat for emphasis.
Is this the look you're talking about?
I suppose so, Einar replied, and he smiled at her.
That moment of reckoning. It's a beautiful thing. You're on the other side of it now. Not like in Thailand. Did you see it? When he realized that actions have consequences.
Mostly, Duan Fen said. I saw his back as he ran away.
He won't be able to run for long.
The two of them stood in the gated driveway of an enormous mansion. Since being recruited by the Foundation, Duan Fen had seen plenty of opulent places like this, but never from this angle. In the past, she was always the one staring out, like the guards at her feet, watching for trouble. Now, she was the danger, the predator. Growing up where she did, a place like this seemed possible only in fairy tales. She gazed at the burbling stone fountain and the gleaming sports cars parked around it. She thought of the executive back in Thailand. All the executives. The well-heeled men who had waved money at her during her pit fights. She liked this view. She enjoyed showing up on their doorstep. According to Einar, the mansion belonged to a member of the Foundation. They had caught him as he was leaving. Driven in a limousine, of course, probably on his way to a swanky New Year's Eve party. The limo's headlights were still on, even though the hood was caved in from where the beast had smashed it apart with his bare hands. Duan Fen limped over to the vehicle, reached past the unconscious driver, and turned it off. Duan Fen heard screaming and more gunshots from inside the mansion. The man they were after had fled that way along with some of his guards. The beast had given chase while she and Einar finished up out here. The beast. That's how she thought of Einar's other associate. the quiet boy who always kept his hood up, who seemed almost impossibly powerful. The beast had broken